Hey, podcast listeners, you're listening to a recording made on the 3rd of August, 2015. And that's different from the date you're about to hear, which is for the broadcast listeners. You, however, are a podcast listener. Recommend your lofty position as a GeekSpeak podcast listener to your pals. And thanks for downloading. This is GeekSpeak for Saturday, August 8th, 2015. We are broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Brian Young, a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer. Hello, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. And Lyle Troxell, software engineer, face painter, and family man.
Hello, Bonnie, and hello, Brian, and hello, everyone.
Hi, everybody. I'm all excited because we are using a shiny new toy here at GeekSpeak that, Brian, you developed from an idea that Miles came up with.
And like most little things that geeks do, it came out of frustration and out of not knowing when the show is going to come to the next break, when we're going to have to stop talking, when the story needs to start or end.
And the Zest Developer, because that's an iOS app.
Yes,
which
yes.
Which is the heck we're talking about to all
yeah,
the people.
It looks like three concentric circles. And as you may be familiar with, there are three basic segments to this show. And so as one segment fills up, it lets me know clearly when to take a break and then how to start up so that it all adds up to one GeekSpeak show.
That's what right. The listeners might not realize is traditionally, as we've done the show, only the one running the board, running the recording equipment, really sees what the timing is.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Yeah. So this way we all get to see and have an organized time making the show for you. If you're curious to know what it looks like, we'll have a video up at geekspeak.org.
And the source code is already up at GitHub on their GeekSpeak repo, which also has the website software. So very cool.
Yeah. So use our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. Let's start the show, Brian, by talking about an exciting new development in memory speed and such.
Oh, yeah. So this one makes me laugh because I've had a tough time explaining RAM, memory in a computer, versus storage, the hard drive or now SSD drives. I've had a hard time explaining that to my mom and dad over the years and all these other people. They just think, oh, it's all the memory of the computer. Mm-hmm. Well, we've had two different technologies. DRAM is what your computer's using most of the time when you're loading up an app, loading up an image into the computer. But as soon as you turn your computer off, it goes away. That's what we call RAM. Mm-hmm. NAND, flash RAM, is persistent. You can write to it. It'll remember it when the electricity goes out. And that's what we use in SSDs.
So this is the thing that replaced hard drives. It's still a long-term storage medium. It has all the storage, big storage space. And it's a lot faster than spinning platters or hard drives, but they're comparable. And that's the NAND stuff, SSDs, all the same thing.
They're both a kind of a transistor. They're both kind of a transistor that holds the memory of the computer, the data of the computer. Well, these technologies have been around for 25 years, more than 25 years. I think 25 years ago is when NAND flash first came out. But we have a new technology on the block now, and this one promises that it not only will be persistent like NAND, but it will be 1,000 times faster.
1,000 times?
That's comparable to RAM.
Yeah, that's approaching RAM speeds. So this technology, it's announced by Intel and Micro. They're going to be coming out with it this year, which is pretty amazing because these kind of stories we usually cover and they're 2, 3, 4 years in the future and we can never know whether it's actually going to come into our devices.
So everyone gets it next year? What?
Well, like all new technology, it's going to be pricey at first, but, there's going to be a lot of, uses in the beginning mm-hmm. that people are going to be willing to pay for this. And then in hopefully in a few years, maybe even less, it's going to come down to the point where it's going to be in our phones. And what this kind of improvement means is that everything that you do on your computer, on your phone, on your electronic devices potentially get much faster. Mm-hmm. Over the past 4 or 5 years, we don't talk about these incredible leaps in processor speed anymore. Mm-hmm. The old gigahertz competitions as people are trying to make faster and faster processor chips. CPUs, it just isn't happening anymore.
Well, we've gone about as small and as fast as we can go, no?
Well, they're getting faster, and we're also putting them on parallel, right? So we're taking processors and making lots of cores. It's one of the things that talk about.
Oh, right, yeah.
But those things don't actually affect most of what you do on your machine, your personal machine, because normally your personal machine's kind of doing one thing. And the stuff that we've actually seen major improvements in the last few years, last 6 years or so, would be graphics cards. So we've actually seen a lot of improvements in graphics cards, which do affect your experience on gaming and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's why your laptop in front of you, Bonnie, can actually run really high-end computer graphics games because of that graphics card.
Right.
But that's because with graphics and any graphics-related thing, you can break up each of that little everything that needs to be processed into a tiny chunk. And anything that can be broken up into tiny chunks can be parallelized.
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 Parallelified. All right. And so now it's finally happening with memory and what
with storage.
With storage, excuse me. And so with storage, what's possible is I can put more stuff on my computer?
Actually, it's more about how fast that stuff can get from your hard drive to an existing and workable space. When we're talking about like a hard drive or even SSD, the difference between those two things is almost more than tenfold, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But still, your computer's performance is mostly bottlenecked on the speed it can get data off the hard drive. Hmm. If you launch a new application you haven't run, like a reboot computer, most of that time takes is pulling that data off that storage medium and putting it in RAM and letting the computer use it.
And just starting up all the gigas that I've set to start up that have set themselves to start up.
And it takes a while to do that.
Yeah.
And at the same time, your computer can run multiple applications. Maybe you'll have Mail open, you have Photoshop open. Switching those two applications that are running at the same time is just moving the processor to run off one application versus another in RAM. And that's why it's so quick. We're talking about with what Brian's chatting about here is a hard drive as fast as RAM would mean that booting up your computer would be like switching applications. It would be extremely fast. Starting an application would just start. It wouldn't have the kind of lag it has. And if you moved a machine, like a general machine, from a hard drive to an SSD, you had an experience like this once already.
So this is
much faster.
I've got a 7-year-old Mac that I did this with last year. And yeah, it was a dramatic speed improvement. But I looked at the stats for the processor. I looked at the stats for the machine, and it really isn't that far behind what's being sold now. Hmm. But when you look deeper, you see that the RAM speed and the RAM bus, the actual electronic bus that takes the data from the chips to the processor, it's dramatically faster now than it was 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing will speed it up even further.
It'll take advantage of that, yeah. Very cool.
And so, once again, it's not coming out for everybody all at once. Really sort of rolled out over time as the technology.
Right. The first high-priced applications come out this year, but hopefully in a couple of years we'll see it.
Great, great. And I want to follow up on another rollout that we were starting to talk about last week, Windows 10.
That's right.
Since the last time that we spoke,
it has
come out.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one of the things I did mention is that when it came out, on a very specific date, not everyone would get it that date. So it's this weird thing where it's available, except for it's not really. And the reason is the way we develop software now, the way we produce software and hand it out to people, is we auto-update everything. We run it programmatically so that it updates all the time. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is we can't trust an individual user to get the most recent updates. Like Brian was saying earlier with experts, we'll talk about that later actually, right, Brian? Talking about how experts actually like to keep their computer up to date, because if you get the most recent patches, your machine is safer and more secure and probably runs the application better. Mm-hmm. But people don't like to do that all the time. They like to just use their computer.
Yeah.
And so software vendors, producers of software, have just been building in auto updates. That auto update means that you're not going to a location and getting a disk anymore. You're getting all your applications through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And when when Microsoft released Windows 10, the entire plan was to have everybody download it and run it. But we're talking about a massive amount of data for going online. And if everyone did it that had Windows at the same time, we'd see the death of the internet. That was people touting it was going to be really bad.
Yeah.
So Microsoft planned to roll it out, and therefore only people get it on certain days.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that over a period of time. And we have a researcher actually did that from Sandvine. Dan Death actually looked at the data packets going across the internet during that rollout phase to see if it got bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually maxed out at 8% of the internet, which is impressive.
That sounds like an amount of the internet.
Yeah.
That's a noticeable amount of the internet.
I would agree.
And it also sounds like a smooth rollout amount of the internet.
Either it was smooth because they did a good job of keeping it down, or not that many people updated. And I don't think he would know what the reason was, because you can detect pretty easily massive amounts of data from one location,
right,
like he did, but it might be still going on at you know, 0.4%.
Oh,
but if
I
it does
see.
That for a long time, that's a lot of people installing, right?
So, right, okay. So we don't have total numbers or anything
right,
like that.
Right.
And our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley, points out that just by comparison, iOS 7 rollout hit about 15% of internet bandwidth.
Right, so maybe they didn't do it as well, or maybe there's more installs.
Maybe more people want it.
And speaking of bandwidth, people like to tout that Netflix, the company I work for, uses about 50% of the internet in the U.S., a third of the internet in the U.S.
Really?
But that's only in the evening, right?
That's right. Well, I would say that it peaks sometimes at that. And actually, I don't even follow those numbers. But we do see large sources of traffic occurring all the time at that kind of massive layers. But having a peak, a short period peak of 8% is impressive, 15% even more so.
Yeah.
A long-term large bandwidth flow is not as much of a problem as peaks. Peaks are the ones that get you because all of a sudden...
You're comfortable just being an internet hog over there at Netflix?
I'm not the hog. Our customers are
the hog.
Hogs.
It's true. I'm blaming myself, aren't I?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're all doing it together, everybody, all you Geek Speak listeners.
Do you remember going back on, was it Usenet or in the early days when I first started using email? I remember somebody berating me for having images in my email, that it was using too much bandwidth.
Right.
I think when people are running their own like email service and stuff, I did this for a while. Yeah, having images, a lot of traffic came across was problematic. But it's funny how, as that became a problem, I'd get my bandwidth upgraded, right? My server would be upgraded. It always seems to follow themselves pretty well. There's rarely like a real bottleneck. I remember that time when images were a no-no in email.
Now we can send 3 gigabytes across.
Yeah, go ahead. Who cares, right?
To millions of people.
We'll have to update all of the articles on email etiquette to account for what's easy
do
now.
Do you guys email anymore?
I do email quite a bit, yeah. For me, I mean, now it's goofy, right? Because you've got the device and it texts, it emails, it calls, it does all the things.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you decide which one to use? And I really just sort of decide in terms of kind of like, is this of something I need you to see right now? Does it need an urgent reply? Can I,
You are putting more thought into it a lot of people, because I have people in my life that go, oh, did you see my email? And I go, what? I look through my email, and I go back, I didn't see your email. Well, I was on Facebook and I emailed you. I'm like, no, you messaged me. So then I go on Facebook and I look at messages. No, it's not there. Then I go on my Facebook page, and see there's a post there from that person publicly talking to everybody.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm like, yeah, that's not email. But describing that.
So when you send a text or an iMessage or whatever, Do you think, oh, this is something that I want to be responded to right now? Or are you willing to say, well, if they get back to me in a day or so, that's fine?
Depends on the person. But I definitely use text messages because I want the person to read it. Right?
Right.
That's what I go back down to.
Text messages for immediate eyeballs. Email for, I was thinking of you.
Yeah.
You can respond or not. And then Facebook if I see that they happen to be there or I use it often.
And what about Twitter and Google Plus and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, no, I don't work for
None
Google.
Of those things.
So. No, I'm working for you, the Geek Speak listener. What we're going to do when we come back on Geek Speak is talk about some habits that ex-security experts use versus lay folk in terms of their own security and more scary things involving snipers and drones and stuff like that. All that is coming up here on Geek Speak. And if you'd like to contact us, you can do so. We are at KUSP Geeks on Twitter. Some people Twitter. I don't know what we are on Google Plus. And we're also KUSP Geeks on Facebook. Or you could email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. That's how you can reach us here at the show. And what you can do is be with us when we come back. You're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Brian Young and Lyle Troxell. And Brian, I want to talk about habits of those who know versus habits of those who are told.
Are you an expert at going online?
Good Lord, no. I do it a lot, but I wouldn't call myself an expert. I would call myself a Jolena user.
Jolena user. So we have a study that was done on what the habits of experts versus lay people are when they're going online, and specifically about security. Mm-hmm. So everybody has their habits and has their tricks on what they do to make sure that they don't get taken over by malware or any of the other viruses out there. This survey asked what your top three habits are that you think protect you.
Okay.
So I'm going to go down a list here, and they're pretty educational on what the difference is between a lay person and an expert is.
What's the first thing that a layperson would do?
First of all, a layperson is going to use antivirus software. That was the top answer that they gave.
I think you guys have advised me to use antivirus
Many
software.
Many times on the radio, we recommend antivirus software on both Windows, especially, and Mac. Though Mac, it's not as important as Windows.
But surely experts also install antivirus software.
Surely, you would think so. But their top answer was to install software updates.
It's interesting because it's comparable. They're different things. But I don't run virus protection software on anything of mine.
Yeah, Lyle and I were shaking our heads because, that's the top thing we do is make sure it's automatically updating and we run home and take care of it as soon as we hear of an exploit.
Let me defend myself here because I do recommend antivirus to people. But I don't use it myself. And the reason is I think
Am I being a patsy? Am I wasting my time using antivirus software?
The reason I don't feel I need to is because I know how to operate my machine in such a way that I can... I egotistically believe that I know how to operate in such a way that I won't get a virus. And this is, not clicking on emails or not running software that has been prompted for me to run from some website. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Those kinds of things are actually very easy to do accidentally if you don't know what you're doing. It's probably easy to do even accidentally if you know what you're doing.
We know that even good websites have code in the ads on the side of them that potentially could attack your machine.
Yeah.
It's not like we know that we're perfectly safe.
But we definitely use a patched version of the operating system, of the browser that we're using, right? We're updating our software all the time. And so when we visit a website and it prompts, hey, you've got to download this application to make yourself safe, I know immediately that that's fake. Right, there's no question in my mind. It's automatic.
Especially if
I can't. Yeah.
I was just going to say, both my mom and my wife got attacked by one that speaks out loud in very scary tones that you're being attacked and you must update your computer.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that sounds very urgent.
So for us, it's a no-brainer that's not something we have to worry about.
Right.
And the secondary thing, I think the backup solution for this is that I actually know if I do get a virus on my machine, I know how to handle that, right? Mm-hmm. I can wipe my computer. I can reset it all. I'll set it all up myself. I'm not going to be days without a machine. I'll actually be up and running relatively quickly because I do all these other things that are difficult to do to make sure that I'm ready to go again on a new machine.
Okay.
So I think those things are the reason why experts don't think it is the primary reason.
You feel like you can handle it if you did get a virus.
Yeah, and I'm aware that I'm being a little... Maybe not being careful enough.
Well, no, ultimately we have backups, and that's where our greatest protection comes from.
The other thing is this is about a list of order, right? I bet somewhere on there for experts is virus protection, but the top one is updates. Makes sense? Yeah.
Number two on the list for a layperson is to use a strong password. Sounds good, right?
Right. Well, don't you guys, you're all the time telling me to use
a
strong password.
We do use strong passwords. What's the expert second choice?
To use a unique password.
Much more important. But also, I always make passwords that are strong. I don't make weak passwords because I inherently think about that.
You're not going to answer with that as your first top choice.
Well, I do have a password that I think is very unique that I use for a lot of stuff.
If you use it for a lot of things, it becomes less unique. Yeah.
Oh, I see. So unique from place to place.
Right. We're covering these stories all the time where some company gets hacked and the passwords and usernames get leaked. Uh-huh. And if your password was in there and then you're also using it somewhere else, all of a sudden someone has your password. Even if it's a strong password, if you have copies of it everywhere, it becomes knowledge.
Hey, look at me.
It's not a secret anymore.
The hackers aren't usually decoding passwords. That's not usually how they get it, unless it's the really, really simple ones.
Well, they social engineer now, don't they?
I mean, it's true that if people use really simple passwords like password or monkey.
Monkey 123.
Yeah. then they don't have to decrypt, and that is a problem. So it's definitely important to have strong passwords, right. But it's just as important to have unique? I don't know. Is it just more?
We should do a community service where we just read all the worst passwords so that everybody goes, oh, mine's in that list.
Yes.
Yes. Definitely.
So number three on the list is for a layperson to change their passwords frequently. And I can't think of any time I've changed one other than when I get
that,
an alert.
I think against all advice, I don't.
No, don't do that. Changing your password's silly. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like
unless
it's
a bad one.
If you have unique passwords like the experts do, mm-hmm. unique passwords for every site, then changing your password on that one site, all that does is go through the process of them having a new one for you. It doesn't really do anything except that now it's harder to remember if you're remembering at all. It's also if you've written it down somewhere or put it in a storage system, you have to update the storage system as well. The only time you really want to do that is when a site gets hacked and they send you an email and say, make sure to change your passwords because that means somebody else can probably get access to your account with that password because they got it somehow, mm-hmm. which is the fault of the target of the site. that you were using.
Okay.
So
okay.
Changing passwords not so good.
So I suddenly do not feel bad that I have not been doing that this whole time. But
do you have unique passwords, Bonnie?
Huh?
Do you have unique passwords? Different passwords for every site?
I have a couple.
Okay. That's better than one.
Okay, yeah.
So number three for the experts.
Yeah,
is,
what do experts do?
Is use two-factor authentication.
Ah, yes.
Oh, now you have told me to do that.
Okay, good.
So, and I have that set up here and there, but not universally.
Yeah, well, it's hard to get universal. Not everyone offers it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Two-factor authentication, of course, is something you know, the secret, the password, and something you have, normally a phone. And so the idea is that even a simple two-factor password thing is you log in with your web browser, Bonnie, you use your password, mm-hmm. and then it says, it texts you a code.
Yeah.
And then your phone gets the code and then you type it in. If you didn't have your phone, you couldn't have gotten in.
Right.
That's kind of a weak two-factor, but it's better than nothing.
Right. And that's the one that I've used.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Weak-ass one.
So number four, lay people only visit websites that they know. And I kind of question this one. That sounds like one of those answers somebody says but doesn't actually do. But
I only go to websites that I know, of course. How do I go there if I don't know it?
That's a trick question.
But what about when you click a link on a news page?
Or? Oh, I see. Yeah, no, I merely go
everywhere we go. I think there's definitely this idea that don't visit websites you're not supposed to visit. There's like an unknown, and I think the layperson's more likely to follow that advice. Though, I don't know how you use the internet with that, right? But then again, if you stick to Wikipedia, first one, your email client webpage, YouTube and Netflix, you're kind of set, right?
Yeah.
And what else do you really do online?
Well, right? I kind of go to Boing Boing.
Oh, and Boing Boing, your perfect several reading sites, maybe Times, right? Reading sites.
But don't accidentally click on the ads and get something injected.
See, the problem I've got with this is that people aren't looking at the source then, right? So they go to some story, they read some blog entry because it's a site they know. Mm-hmm. Then it says, go read the rest of the story some other
place.
Or there's
some hypertexted thing and you click on the hypertext and, oh, it's an ad. What the hell?
Yeah, it might be. But the point is that people are only digesting what they feel is in their safe comfort area. They're not doing their own research. That means they're not growing as much as
so what's the expert counterpart to that?
Oh, number four, it's not related, but it says use strong passwords. We already talked about that. It's just a little bit below where the layperson might have put it.
Oh, I see.
Number five for the layperson is don't share personal information on the web.
Well, that sounds like a really good one.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
What's the five for experts?
Well,
don't share personal information.
No, don't share your passwords on the internet.
Yeah, really.
Number five for experts is to use a password manager. And
yes.
We already talked about that.
Okay,
but
yeah.
How can you remember unique passwords?
You can't remember unique passwords. The only way to deal with that is a password manager.
Well, what's the length of the password you told me that you just spent the time to learn?
I have a 20-something character password. That's my crypt password for my password manager, and I only use it there.
And there's no words in that.
No, it's I actually generated a random thing.
Numbers, letters,
there was stuff
capital,
in there.
Lowercase,
details,
all
right?
Of it, yeah.
Because every time I talk about it, anything I talk about, like I used to say the length and I used to say like how many numbers and stuff, but I realized that actually defeats the purpose. Like it should be not known to anybody and it's random.
Like, hey, guess what I've got? Here's a clue.
Mine's really nice.
Yeah.
I love that it has the word window in the middle of it. Oh, no! Anyway, no, I had a computer generate the random because humans are really bad at random.
Yeah. So a great infographic that goes along with this. And who made that infographic? Where'd you find that?
This is a Google Online Security Blogspot post. And definitely take a look at it. There's a lot more detail in there. And it's really interesting to go down the list of questions as well.
Yeah.
And let me just say, password managers, they're now supported in iOS. They're supported in Android. And they're supported in your Windows or Macintosh. And this basically means you get a piece of software that runs and holds your passwords for you, and it does it in such a way that it's encrypted and safe, and it's really great, and I recommend LastPass and 1Password. I use 1Password, though I've tried LastPass. They're both great.
Are those the
you
only two? Is it like
There's a whole bunch of them. In fact, a few shows ago, and I'll link to it, we talked about an open source one that works on Windows and Mac as well if you want to go open source. The point, though, is you have to commit to this system because once you do this, all your passwords are random. Basically, you never memorize them. You hopefully never even type them in because the management software can actually type them in for you. So it really becomes a great thing. I'm imagining iOS 10 will actually build this into the operating system because
I've been hoping for it.
It probably will. I mean, they already have some kind of things like that. But anyway, enough of that.
Last question. Mm-hmm. So would you say it is better to have all your passwords written down in a book next to your computer? Is that safer than using 1Password for all the same sites?
Are they different random passwords?
Yeah, different random passwords.
How do you get the random passwords?
Oh, that's a good question.
Okay, so let's say you have like a random button next to your computer and it goes bloop and makes a random button. And then you write that down on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you have the absolute best passwords in the world, but they're written in a book next to your computer. Is that safer than having the same password on every site?
Safer from the general internet? Yes. Safer from your family? No. If you have a 13-year-old child, might not be the best bet.
We'll find it. Well, we have time for another discussion, don't we, before we go to our next break? So here's something. That last week, we were talking about Flash and how Flash is just over and dead, and everyone's just, like, pooing on it and saying, forget you, Flash. You're the Bill Cosby of technology. It's just, like, thing non grata now.
It's just kicking things down.
Yeah. And so now people have turned their sights on Android. Why?
Well, so there's this interesting article, and the issue with this article, well, let me first describe it. It's a teardown of how Android, the Android operating system, is a lot like Flash in that way that you were kind of referring to. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about Flash is that for a while it was kind of required everybody get this plugin. So these Flash plugins existed everywhere. Adobe writes Flash, and people were using it for lots of content. And the trouble was that it was a very robust, powerful programming environment that was controlled by one company, and there'd be vulnerabilities in that software package, so you'd have to update. Mm-hmm. And there two things happened because of this. One is that people had to always kind of update Flash. They got used to updating, used to the prompts. So then people that wanted to take over your computer just wrote something that looked like a Flash prompt to install viruses.
I'll click that.
Right. So that's one problem. Mm-hmm. But the secondary problem is that they never really got rid of all the bugs. And Flash kind of was a memory hog for some devices. So when Apple released the iPhone, Apple said, no more Flash. We're not having Flash on the iPhone. And that kind of was the start of the demise of Flash. Mm-hmm. It slowly became less and less important.
It had one other great advantage for the hackers. They could write one hack that would work on all systems.
That's true. You could normally take a vulnerability of any system running it. That's true.
And is that true for Android also?
So Android's its own operating system. So from that perspective, it's extremely different. Mm-hmm. But one of the issues with Flash is it kind of stayed around forever. And Android devices kind of stay around forever. And what's going on with Android, we were talking about making sure experts...
Oh, you mean like old ones? Like one thing that kind of annoys me actually about Apple is like, oh, geez, now I got the new thing and now I have to have a new adapter and a plugger and they're changing things all the time. And from what you're saying, by that token, I would be relieved that my Android device that I bought a million years ago still works.
It's great that it still works. Unfortunately, early versions of Android had some serious problems. Hmm. The reason that article was concerning me at first is it actually comes from AppleInsider.com.
Yeah, wait a minute.
So if you have an article talking from Apple, basically from Apple fan people, about how bad Android is, you have to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
So I read the article and thought it was pretty – they had really good cogent reasons that it was true, and therefore I believed it. But then I went ahead and checked with Miles. Mm-hmm. And Miles said, yeah, that's my perspective too. The issue around Android is it's that it's not updating. And what's happened is you get a smartphone from some carrier. They do the cheapest line possible. They say, hey, here's a free phone with your connection. And that's a great deal, right? Mm-hmm. You got your service that costs a certain amount a month. You got a new phone that's an Android device, maybe a smart screen, does web browsing, all this wonderful stuff. But the carrier doesn't really care about updating your phone.
So who is the sort of central
updaterator? That's right.
Yeah.
So the carrier doesn't really care because that phone has maybe some other name on it, like Samsung. Mm-hmm. Samsung either made a deal with the carrier to get it in cheap and therefore didn't have a rule where they were going to update it, or Samsung doesn't really care because they have the newest, greatest thing. So there's a bit of whose responsibility is it to update the operating system? Mm-hmm. But the problem is no one's taking the responsibility. So we have millions of devices out there that are just really old Android devices. And so they have problems. They have security vulnerabilities.
Okay. And then they wind up infecting each other? Is that a thing that happens?
Well, no, there's just vulnerabilities out there, and it's easier for the hackers to get something onto that device and get all the contacts or do something else.
There's a secondary system, and that's the stores. So in comparison, Apple, the hardware thing, they have a brand to protect. And so when they have a vulnerability in their operating system, even an old one, they'll actually produce a patch to patch it, and they'll push it if they can to all the devices. They also made more hard deals with the carriers. When they made the first deal with AT&T, it was very clear who was going to own the device and who was going to update it. It was going to be Apple. That was a breach completely from what carriers were used to. Mm-hmm. So Apple kind of got that from the beginning, which was good because they get to update the operating system. And then secondarily, Apple made it a closed ecosystem. They control the store. Anyone wants to participate with their device effectively, you've got to go through Apple. So they actually review all the software. So when Brian tries to put his timer app on the App Store, somebody at Apple is going to look at it and see if he knows what he's doing and see if there's any backdoors or vulnerabilities in it, and they'll deny it if there's any problems.
Okay, I hear that Android fanboy out there saying, but they just started doing that for the Android store as well.
Yeah, there's got to be some hope.
The thing is, if you're going to buy a new device right now, I don't think you even have this problem. Like, it's not a future problem. it's a past problem, right?
Right. It's a problem with the old stuff.
Yeah. And right now, like if you buy a phone from Apple, what is it? From Google, the Nexus brand,
yeah.
Nexus
mm-hmm.
5, Nexus 6.
Nexus, yeah.
Yeah. Those devices actually are auto-updating from Google. So in that regard, you're going to have the best and
there's
greatest all the
true,
time, just like Apple.
Clear owner.
That's right.
Yeah, there's
okay.
a number of companies that are trying to make a name for themselves by offering that. I believe HTC does that as well.
Mm-hmm. So this may not be like pooping on Android and having it go away the way Flash is. May not be a win for Apple necessarily, but maybe for some other alternate to Apple.
Well, I think that one of the
like
problems...
Google.
Yeah. But I think one of the problems we have with this Android ecosystem that I don't know if is being addressed yet is the very low-end devices have these problems. We just said HTC okay. is really on top of it. And Apple direct devices are really... I mean, sorry, Google's direct devices are really
right.
on top of it. Apple's really on top of it. All of these are high-end devices.
Right, okay.
So the high-end device market from now on is not a problem. If you want to spend $600 on a phone or comparably a contract that's cost that much, you probably won't have a problem with this. But it's everybody
those
else,
who can't,
which
yeah.
is most people.
It right. used to be a low-end phone just did not perform very well. But now even the low-end phones
are
coming
amazing.
Out now, they've got enough power that they can perform as much as anybody needs.
So,
but without the security
well,
checks and balances.
Maybe.
They
maybe
come
not.
Out with it. The question is, can they stay updated? And
yeah.
we really need to – I'm an Apple fanboy. But I really think we need to put pressure on the Android ecosystem to make sure this gets solved. Because
yeah.
we just don't need all of this personal data being attacked and all these phones out there that can be turned into a botnet or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And we have found over time that if we focus only on the actual device system that we care about, that's not the way to deal with it. Because the side effect of having all these devices that are out there and open and have problems is that everybody has problems. The more systems out there that are breachable, the worse the environment is. It's like a bad neighborhood, right?
Right.
The worse it gets, the worse it is for everybody. Even if you have a nice car in that neighborhood, you're kind of screwed, right? So,
but is an individual member of that neighborhood redeemable? Do you really want Android to die?
I don't want Android to die at all. I think
what
it's
about
been
you,
fantastic.
Brian?
And personally, I think it's the cell phone carriers that we really need to put the pressure on because they're the ones that have really held this up as much as anybody.
And it's so fun to hate them.
Yeah, that's easy.
Because we have to pay them monthly.
All right. So that shines a little light on that whole hubbub.
Yes, the
yeah.
Android hubbub. And I thought it was a great article. It'll, of course, be at geekspeak.org. If you'd like to read the whole
yeah,
article.
Thank you. I think I would like to read it. Listen, when we come back, we really are going to get to some kind of scary sniper rifle nonsense and a few other things. You're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. We'll be right back. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primch, and I'm speaking with Lyle Troxell and Brian Young, and I've been promising some news about some kind of a sniper rifle thing, Lyle, but I don't even know what I'm talking about.
You know, it actually has a great connection with the hacking stuff we were talking about earlier.
Okay.
So, did you know that there's a sniping rifle? This is like a military sniping rifle called TrackPoint, and it's a self-aiming rifle?
What?
Guns and electronics?
I didn't know this happened either. But yes, and it does make sense. If you've ever seen like a sniper movie, some kind of military thing, you've got a person with a gun,
yeah.
and then right next to you, you have a person called a spotter. And they use optics and wind detection and all this calculation stuff. In fact, for a while, it's actually like a navigator of these rifles because the rifles can shoot so far that any deviation is a problem. Additionally, the spotter will see, oh, the bullet hit here and therefore shift. Well, if you took all those activity and you put it in the computer aiming system, like our cameras and our phones
mm-hmm.
actually have stabilization systems
yeah.
that can warp. That actually, what's going on is either the sensor is moving or the lens itself shifts, and it shifts to any movement and vibrations. So if you do that with the rifle, if you actually have mechanics in there that will modify for slight problems, it's great because if the person's wiggling a little bit, there's vibrations, all those can be dampened. Actually, aiming systems can target and modify where the reticule is based on distance, based on wind.
Mm-hmm.
And so the gun actually thinks for you and then helps you fire and hit your target. So... The TrackPoint self-aiming rifle also costs a little bit of money. It's $15,000.
Okay.
So there is that. I'm sorry, $13,000.
Only the rich people can automatically shoot people.
Yes. Well, I'm not talking about people, hopefully, but yes, it theoretically is, of course, for killing. It also has a Wi-Fi access point. Therefore, you can...
I don't like where this is going.
And there you go. So a married hacker couple is about to present at Black Hat, the Black Hat convention.
Runes
Sadvik and Michael Auger, have been working for about a year hacking into this rifle. They got one of these rifles, actually got a pair of these rifles, and they've been working on how to potentially take advantage of the system. Now, though this rifle really is supposed to just correct for environment variables, since there's a processor in there, and that processor corrects by moving the aiming system, you therefore could have it hit a different target. Now, it's not going to shoot and turn around on you, but you could deviate it quite a bit or just disable it completely, which they've been able to do these things and they're about to present on it. When I just think it's great. When you put smarts in things, you got to be careful.
Yeah, don't put dumbs into things.
Yeah.
I may have permanent frowny face for the rest of the show.
I wonder if it's running Android.
Oh, God.
No, it's certainly some Linux variety.
Yeah, definitely.
So we can bundle that in with all of the stuff we were talking about last week in terms of... when all these technologies exist and are rattling around loosely together, what happens when someone strings them all together?
You know, you hope that when Skynet attacks, you don't only have smart weapons to fight down the ships that are attacking you, because they'll just turn them off.
Well, it just gets back to Battlestar Galactica. We got to run with computers that aren't connected to the
internet.
Got to
go analog, baby.
Yep.
Oh, man. That just gave me a chill. Brian, can you help me recover in any way? You've got some news about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Is it good news by any chance?
Yeah, actually, it is really good news. There was a case that is going to change, at least in this district, how the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is interpreted. So we've talked about this over the years. This is a law that came out and was passed in 1998. And this was responsible for things like not being allowed to decode your DVDs and make a MP4 on your hard drive that you can play back. Technically, for quite a while, that was against the DMCA.
Right.
And more importantly, going through and hacking and figuring out the encryption that keeps that on the disk, that specifically was against the law.
Yeah, the law codified something that's a little creepy, right? The idea was that we want to protect copyright, so any knowledge about how to circumvent copyright is illegal, which means knowledge itself was illegal. Researching to solve the problem of how to take something apart was illegal.
Oh.
And it really didn't feel good to geeks, right? We like to backwards engineer things because it's fun, right?
Yeah.
I have a system at home that controls my watering system, and it's a piece of hardware. It's a Wi-Fi access point that controls when water goes on and off, right?
Yeah.
And I want the ability to be able to go in there and modify it and tinker and play and figure it out.
Well it's just like it's just like car geeks of yesteryear
that
got frustrated with all the electronics and other automatic systems that go into cars. Geeks still want the power to be able to own their own devices and do something with them.
And so the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was despised by us geeks because it made just doing that illegal. Not even telling other people about it, but doing it illegal.
Not even selling something that you decrypted.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's going on? What's this new interpretation then?
Okay, so there was a case down in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which General Electric bought a company back in 2001 that they were part of their system, these UPS systems that they managed and repaired. You needed to use a little USB dongle that would give you the ability to run the tests and repair the devices.
You had to have a specific thing.
Right.
Unentered power supply. It's those little batteries that make sure your computer don't get shut down when the power goes out.
Mm-hmm.
So the company that was doing this ran into the problem that these dongles only had a limited number of uses or limited number of times they could be used. And eventually they got to the point where they actually just broke the encryption that held the software on that dongle and started using the software that they legally owned and had the purposeful right to use, and they got sued for this.
Okay,
so,
that's not good.
With the caveat that they figured backward engineered it, therefore they broke the Millennium Copyright Act law that I just was complaining about, right?
So I realize I stumbled through that, but the important part of this case is that the judge said that clearly just being able to break the encryption was not going to be running afoul of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You actually had to do something that would break the original copyright
as well with
the material that you were working on.
He basically solved it for us. Like one fell swoop just was like, that's stupid. That never was meant to be intended that way. Boom. Now, we'll see if an appeal happens.
Yeah, what happens from here?
And we'll see if
it goes
to the Supreme
Court. It's very exciting that this could happen.
And if the Supreme Court just doesn't want to listen to it, then that'd be fantastic.
Then it's law.
I think if they listened to it, the whole argument would come to a real, intelligent debate. which I'm hoping, like, if they listen, I'd love for it to
more
be right to the Supreme Court. I think it's a really interesting idea. Like, do you own the things you own or not? Because if you can't backward engineer, it's like if I give you a rake and you can't take the rake apart to find out how the metal part connected the wood part, that would be illegal to figure that out. That's the kind of thing we're talking about here.
It's like, yeah, like not owning what you really think
you own.
You
own the rake. Well, of course, you don't own software, but that's a different problem.
The DVD example is so prime because here we are, and I don't even think I have a DVD player in the house right now that's hooked up to a TV that I could play any DVDs on.
But so, you probably have home videos of your kids on a DVD.
Oh, absolutely. But I also have movies that I bought on a DVD that I've long since ripped and put on my media center. And for anybody to claim that that was illegal just rubs me the wrong way.
You're just making it more convenient to use for you personally.
Yeah.
And it also strikes me that when geeks like to essentially reverse engineer things and find out how they work, that essential curiosity and that impulse to find out is what got a lot of geeks into geekdom.
Absolutely. Without that, I mean, that's why we do it, I think.
Yeah. And the satisfaction of being able to answer that question for yourself, I'm sure, was a motivating factor to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. I think puzzle, geeks are puzzle solvers, but not puzzles in the sense that, I mean, at least I speak for myself. I don't particularly like puzzles as the sake of puzzles. I like problems that feel like a puzzle. When you solve them, you've done something unique. I like the unique quality of a problem. So there's a different aspect than a puzzle everybody's done before.
Right. Yeah. I know how this puzzle works.
Right.
It is boring.
So
figuring a puzzle out for the first time kind of.
It gets interesting though. I mean, you're not against copyright. You're not against patents per se, or maybe, it's actually kind of murky because we have these things so that people do creative works and that they can add to human knowledge and knowing that they'll be rewarded, being paid for what they've done.
Right.
At the same time, I'm not so sure either the patent system or the copyright system is currently supporting that as well as it should, because it's the balance has gone too far towards the copyright and patent holders and not enough to the common good of knowledge.
We've had a couple shows about copyright with copyright lawyers and such, and I used to be very negative of copyright. Now I'm highly positive of both copyright and patent intentions, like the reason they exist. Trademark as well. Actually, trademark's almost like a slam dunk. I really believe in trademark. But copyright and patents, the reason why I have so much trouble with them is in their implementation, the current implementation, not about the core idea.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that a person being creative should have some time to benefit from that creativity is so important because that helps support that person being creative. And additionally, if you write a song, Bonnie, and you've released that, and Brian wants a song, he should either be able to get that song from you at some rate, or if there's a value to him yet getting it, he might actually invest in someone else producing new work, right? So there's great benefit to having these copyright and patents. The problem is the current implementation just doesn't work really.
So it's, once again, it's about nuance, about coming with a more nuanced and responsive system, giving all of the gray area.
Speaking of non-nuance, I got a little funny story. Antivirus company, actually a big one, Bitdefender. Was hacked. And so they're
that doesn't sound like good news at all.
It's not good news, but it's one of those kind of like, but also kind of, because they're an antivirus company, right? Which is supposed to be helping you be safe from threats of your computer. And yet their computer system got hacked. They're being actually blackmailed for $15,000. Theoretically, supposedly, the person that's doing this, who's Nom de Plume is Detox Ransom. I'm sure that was made up for this ransoming. Mm-hmm. Basically says that Bitdefender had a whole bunch of usernames and passwords in a database. They got access to the database. The passwords were not encrypted. They have full blanket access to all of it. The end of the story is not complete, but this right there is a perfect reason why you need unique passwords. Because
if
you ever use Bitdefender, that password hackers have.
Okay, well, I haven't, thank goodness. But
good.
I'm going to be studying over that infographic.
That's another reason why not to use virus protection, right?
Yeah, exactly. The antivirus companies can't keep themselves safe.
Hey, I hear there was a success recently in optical research.
Yes.
Our Canadian correspondent says that optic computing is ever closer, and I don't know what that means.
Well, this is one of those stories that, for me to describe fully what's happening, is probably beyond my ability. I have an electronics degree and all that, but I just love the paragraph that we pulled from this research paper, so I thought I'd read it to really feel what geek speak is like to everybody in the sense that it's hard to understand. Researchers from the laboratory of nano-optics and plasmotics at the MIPT Center of Nanoscale Optoelectronics have developed a new method for optical communication on a chip, which will give a possibility to decrease the size of optical and optoelectronic elements and increase the computer performance several tenfold, according to their article published in Optics Express. They have proposed the way to completely eliminate energy loss of surface plasmons in optical devices. I don't even know what a plasmon is.
I still don't know.
No, it's wonderful.
What the success is in optics research.
Well, faster, cheaper, less loss of energy. Basically, when you're dealing with optics, one of the things you want in any electronics, you want to reduce waste. Waste is heat energy or loss of power.
Yeah.
Because when you lose power in a system, the system gets hot. That's why our computers have fans in them, because of all the excess heat. And so this is using optics at a cooler level. It's the best way to describe it. And it's a tenfold increase, which means, of course, smaller and better and faster and all those things.
Okay. And so what makes it optical versus what?
So, you know, when we talk about fiber optics and they have really high speeds?
Oh, right.
The interface between electronics and fiber optics is producing light, right? And then being able to read light. That optocoupling, that ability to do transferring of those two systems is an energy intensive process. Well, not really energy intensive, but there's some bit of loss there. This system would be able to make that cheaper and better. If you could get it really inexpensive, you could potentially use optics inside a computer to move data along bandwidth lines.
Optics within the computer itself?
There's not a lot of benefit there unless there's almost low loss. Mm. And wires actually don't have a lot of loss at short distances. That's why I don't see optics inside a computer.
Okay. Yeah.
But interfaces that use optics in general have an expense because of their usage. So this could improve that to some degree. This is, you know, low-level research that will be implemented in some way yet to be known, but it gets better.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. You know, I haven't heard nearly enough about scary automatic weaponry that can
you didn't
fly
like the
in the air.
Oh, flying. Okay. I didn't do that.
Brian, I hear there was some other shenanigans in the whole thing about guns and drones.
Shenanigans, yes.
So it's like a new segment, guns and drones.
Guns and drones. No, drones are definitely becoming the robot story of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So,
hitchhiking robot, rest in peace.
You're gonna have to explain that one.
I may have to. I don't know. It's been all over. But please proceed.
Okay, go look up Hitchbot. It's a very
Hitchbot.
Cute story.
You'll
very fun
it.
Story.
We'll link to it.
But we're not going to cover it today.
No.
So, we covered that on a former episode of Geek Speak.
Well, it has a new twist to it.
All right,
today.
Let's do this story about the flying one.
So a few weeks ago, we were talking about somebody mounting a gun on a drone.
Yeah, and that was scary.
And we've talked about drones in warfare weaponized drones.
Yeah.
This turns the tables because somebody was enjoying a good flight of their drone around their neighborhood, and a neighbor felt that he was being intruded upon, that this drone was intruding on his neighbor. Mm-hmm. And so he thoughtfully decided that he would get his shotgun and wait until this drone went over his land, because he figured if it's on his land, or I guess above it, he has the right to take the drone into his own hands. So he shot it with a shotgun and took the drone down. So,
is there a law about that yet?
There are guidelines from the FAA,
right.
And there are some laws that apply here. But, you know, it kind of gets into some gray areas. But the man was arrested for destroying this $1,800 drone. This was in Kentucky.
Okay.
And David Boggs, the owner of the drone, said he was just having fun flying around trying to take pictures of his friend's house when... But the man who shot the drone felt that it was too close to his property and was only 10 feet off the ground, and it shouldn't have been there. So the FAA does give guidelines that a drone should fly below 400 feet so as not to prevent firefighters and airplanes from flying in that area.
It's supposed to stay out of the way of the real flying machines.
Exactly.
Okay.
But as far as a a device, a car, a cow being on your property, the law says pretty clearly that you are allowed to remove that that object. Mm-hmm. You are allowed to charge the person who has put that object on your property, mm-hmm. but you are not allowed to destroy that piece of
property. Oh, so we kind of goofed there.
So that's interesting because public airspace in the U.S. is above 500 feet. So if you're 500 feet above a property, you're not on their property. You're right. In flight, and that's public. Mm-hmm. So you can legally fly. That's why helicopters and such can. Now, there's different zoning rules and all that, and you have to stay above 1,000 feet of any obstacle, things like that, of buildings and things of that nature. But if the FAA is saying stay under what height?
400.
But the flight height is 500. Technically, they can shoot it down, right? I mean, it seems like that would be their property.
Yeah, yeah, but there's other considerations as well.
But not destroying the thing, but just removing or...
Well, if you take a look at the picture of this man's yard, this is not a large yard. That the shot from that gun, from that shotgun, has to go somewhere. So yeah. I don't recommend pulling out your gun in your neighborhood just to take down the drone.
The cool thing is that this is completely an FAA rule because FAA has the sole authority to deal with above 500 feet again. But I think that's their declaration of what public space is, so...
I'm not sure. It just seems bad. All this drone stuff, drones and guns, it seems like a bad combination. I'll be very sad if we do, in fact, wind up having a regular Geek Speak segment called Guns and Drones.
Well, let me just say that I feel much better about drones being shot down than drones shooting down. Like, to me, the gun being in the human's hand and the robot being fired at is a better scenario than reversed.
Even when it's in a close-knit neighborhood and could have, you know, knocked my eye!
Was discharging a shotgun a good idea? Yeah, I mean, it seems like that would be problematic.
What I want to know is, did the operator of the drone actually see that the man had a shotgun?
And did he flinch?
Well, guys, I'm going to end the show there on Guns and Drones. Tune in next week to find out what gets shot and by what. And you're listening to Geek Speak. It's a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so feel free to use whatever you like from us. Just cite your sources. Thanks. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. Our theme music is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primch with Lyle Troxell and Brian Young. Geek Speak is produced by Lyle Troxell, and thanks to our intern Chandler, our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley, and thank you for being here for the August 8th episode of Geek Speak.